Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record permanently archived at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with Mike Smith's novel, The Eradicator, out published in 2024. We're going to do chapter 15 and 16. Not super long. Let's get into it. Chapter 15 of The Eradicator, titled Hard Work and Respect for Education. Chapter 15, Hard Work and Respect for Education. Reva Ackerman sneered, page 120. Reva Ackerman sneered. She always sneered when she slid into the back of the limo. Her face had the immobility of a lizard's, usually, but on these occasions her long mouth curled, her eyes rolled slightly, and her slit nostrils almost flared. "The club," she instructed the driver. The only thing that never changed was her delicately articulated pronunciation, but her voice never concealed the brass that might sound at any moment like a prairie dog's head popping out of a desert hole. She prided herself on 2 points concerning her appearance. First, she had a gumdrop nose, not a beakish and really not conspicuous from the side, and secondly, she had blonde hair. They were natural, from interbreeding by her careful family, and inspired the only gratitude she ever, rarely, felt. She had just left a meeting with a tenant. Old Bill Gustafson had failed to pay his rent in full for 3 months running. Although they were theoretically a hassle, she always watched special collections. For these events, she paid members of the Silver Gang to collect from the deadbeat or to give them a lesson from their capable hands. The Silver Gang. "No, but I can't pay. I told you. When I have the money, I will try." All deadbeats, the same excuses, she thought. They all make the same excuses, even when the blood runs out of their mouths. The Silver Gang boys were especially persuasive with Gustafson. He begged on his popping knees. She appreciated that, but got no unusual pleasure from the spectacle. Her face showed no more than annoyed contempt. As for the boys, they had worked efficiently and expressionlessly, remorselessly. When she left, she was satisfied that her point was made. She got her pound of flesh. Even with 12 drinks in her, she realized she felt better than expected. She was almost unbent to the point of smiling. She not only owned 2 properties as a medieval lord might rule a fiefdom, she had an abundance of pies in the oven today, and today a few of the bigger ones were coming out excellently. For example, this morning, a new flytrap replaced Kill 'Em All. Kill 'Em All was FBI setup group, you'll recall. She had helped to found Kill 'Em All and had even run most of its operations. Though its expected finale had come and gone, her colleagues had activated the group on tap handily, and she was happy about that, though naturally she could have no role in it. She believed it was called Citizen Patriots for Common Sense, or Patriotic Common Sense Citizens, or something like that. If she had cared, she could have learned the name from any of the 3 cousins of hers who worked for the FBI. She didn't care. The intelligence agency that had recruited her in college taught her to move from one operation to the next without looking back. So far, it hadn't assigned her to an operation to follow Kill 'Em All. Besides, her cousins lived in D.C. She had her practice here in Chicago, so it wasn't convenient to meet frequently. They didn't have to, though. They spoke over the phone in the high holy days, and that was enough to transact business. Her practice wasn't the only business she had. Besides the rental property, she sat on the board of directors of 5 Doctors Pharmaceuticals. She chuckled inwardly at that phrase, sat on the board of directors. She reviewed her trysts with a number of other board members. Chuck she certainly sat on in more ways than one. But Chuck was in Buenos Aires for the last year. She resumed thinking of recent wins. Chuck not only sat on 5 Doctors' board, but got even wealthier in the boards of 2 defense contractors, Groom and Easton and Beamerad, and he had made her privy to a planned South American insurrection that might not only lift him higher, but lift her out of her practice. Her practice also involved some intelligence work, but mostly bored her. Her MD she got from being helped with her MCAT and having her residency requirement waived, and the only part of the work that interested her was giving expert testimony in murder cases involving apes. She frequently had the opportunity to help apes and their handlers beat a rap, because a local judge was an old friend. They had again cooperated only last week. Her testimony in that trial helped to show that the victim, by dying in the course of defending his twin sister from an assault by an orangutan, was a humanist and deserved what he got, and that the orangutan must be honored by acquittal lest it experience, quote, additional psychic pain. She got a kick out of that, and out of all her other social justice work, and all of it was going well. She had enjoyed participating in a recent action. On Wednesday, she marched in a rally for GAI. She and the Jewish Federation of Justice had organized it. All the trustees of the Federation were friends. They had marched in Federal Plaza, carrying banners, singing songs, socializing, despite the cold weather. It had been more than street party than protest. No one pointed out that no reason existed for rallying for GAI, a settled policy. The purpose of rallies was not to protest power, but to celebrate it. So a great many people, some of them not even Jews, had joined the rally, their faces stiff with safe self-righteousness. Who didn't like power? The banners had read, "Great Ape Inclusion is Just," "Love Wins," "Humanists Out," and "There is No Place for Humanity Here." Masses of hired police kept away any possibility of ape contact. Now, as she rode to the club, a text message interrupted her reverie. It too was good news. Chuck had succeeded. An insurrection would take place only 3 days from now. She felt the almost satiating sensation of receiving what she deserved. The money Grumman Easton and Beamerad would make out of this would stupefy Croesus, most likely King Croesus, the richest man ever in Greek mythology. The money wasn't the most important thing to her. She thought of the country whose government would be replaced. She didn't remember its name, but that wasn't important. What mattered was that its citizens would be undone. The lives of Gentile roaches would be rocked, destroyed. And that was a good thing, a victory for democracy. She looked out the window. The limo pushed through a typical area, and she saw the people in the street and on the sidewalk. They too were roaches. They staggered around more like zombies, casualties of a different war, the drug epidemic. Opioids, fentanyl, crack, vaccines, meth, and more had ruined them. The feeling of glee rose in her. She felt it for a reason that no one else or few people knew. She felt super motivated to go to the club now. Her driver wondered why she laughed out loud all of a sudden. She sat up when the limo pulled into the closed street where the club was. The driver rolled past the barriers by flashing a card bearing a symbol. This symbol matched the sign above the rundown building, a Christian cross, neon lit and turning like a top. She walked into the club after emitting girlish pleasantries to her old and dear friend, the bouncer. The tidal wave of noise and near-total disappearance of light didn't faze her. She was used to it. She immediately oriented herself and gave the prospects a look-over. Club Redeemed had the reputation of a meat market, but everything did nowadays. She saw a tall couple, the man having a nose ring and his husband wearing a dog collar and nothing else. She passed on them. She saw a probable female with green hair and passed on her. She saw a midget with no nose and passed. She saw a muscled albino, very unusual, but pass. Making an assignation presented a challenge tonight, but she would do it even if it took hours. She redoubled her search, moving her eyes from face to face, ass to ass. She wanted a special thrill, an unusual conquest. The strobing light punctuated her darting gaze. She weaved through jiggling swarms of dancers. Ironically enough, she found her conquest after giving up. He was leaning against the bar, staring at her openly. She felt a welcome thrill of anticipation, not just because of his insolent stare, but because he was disabled. He had a prosthetic arm and leg. It was this combination of manliness and injury that intrigued her. She approached him. "Buy you a drink?" He said, "What?" "Buy you a drink?" she repeated. She didn't mind that he refused the drink. She already had a hand on his prosthetic arm. Its material felt hard and cold, and she left with him. She didn't drag him into the stinking darkness of the back rooms because she wanted the adventure of taking him home. The limo picked them up. The driver said nothing as they got in, her face full of domineering anticipation, his blank but watchful. She scooted to him, seating her half her rear end on his prosthetic leg and letting the other half remain on the car seat. Her sloppiness didn't surprise Chad. He had located her in Chicago from information on the pill bottle. He had found her photo from 20 hours of searching online. A hunch that the name Reva was Haji led him to sex clubs which, as he knew, Hajis loved to visit, Islam or no Islam. She was as familiar to a Haji as Josh was, anyway, and he knew he could handle Hajis. "What do you do?" he asked her. She scooted away and looked out of the window. "I'm a doctor. Do you need pain medication?" "I'm feeling no pain, doll." Her face assumed a superior smirk. He moved close to her. "Look at those people," he said. They watched the addict stumbling around on the sidewalk. She nodded. "Oh, yes. Five doctors helped some of them. That's my prescription partner," she added with a mysterious smile in her voice. "They look helped." Chad got away with the sarcastic tone of this comment by breathing it near her ear. She said condescendingly, "Five docs does great social work. We're reducing that plague you see there. Some of our treatments are as effective as the most favored pesticides." Then she laughed. "You wouldn't understand that." Chad understood that the plagues which prescriptions had unleashed on common people amused her, but he had to check himself and kept quiet. He had to get the information gradually. He wanted to know who paid her. Five doctors wasn't enough of a clue, but he would get others out of her. On to 125. The limo reached her home. She lived in an apartment building, 10 stories, designed by a famous Jewish architect so as to resemble a pile of garbage toppling over. Only the high grates and guard shacks surrounding it seemed to contain it. "It's all right, Samuel," she said to one of the guards, smiling. "He's harmless." Sam, plainly hyper-suspicious, took a frowning look at Chad and then said, "Yes, Mrs. Ackerman. Ms. Ackerman." "Oh, Ackerman," Chad said as the limo moved on. He was pretending that he didn't know her name before. She said nothing. The limo let them out in the parking garage. She led Chad into the elevator, still holding his prosthetic arm imperiously like a slave trader transporting the goods. The elevator stopped in her apartment on the 6th floor. The place had to be 3,000 square feet at least, but he couldn't survey it very well because its dark corridors snaked everywhere. "Nice," he said politely. "Shut up," she said. She looked him up and down for a full minute, smiling at him, or at her catch, while he stood there waiting. She laughed. "Are you a war farmer?" she said, evidently referring to his prosthetics. He didn't know what she meant, but he nodded. "Come on," she said at a sudden thought. "I'll give you a little tour. You should thank me for that privilege." "Thank you, ma'am," he said. She took him through the apartment, showing him her art collection. Some framed, some stretched. The artworks hung on the walls and were all shapes and sizes, the majority large. The first hallway was practically a museum display of antique Soviet propaganda posters. Made in the Bolshevik era, they depicted idealized farmers and giant tractors standing on endless furrows under iron skies, beefy factory workers in giant boots stepping on enemies. That's a typo in the text. Stepping on bottom page 125, stepping on enemies who scattered like ants. Large cap Cyrillic lettering seemed to shout from among these overconfident images. So she has a whole bunch of Soviet propaganda posters. "Is this communist propaganda?" Chad asked. "Agitprop is what they are," she corrected him. The next hallway held a collection of photographs of children suffering from ape-caused injuries. Frame photo after photo showed crying faces and maimed bodies. Children missing limbs and screaming in distress, one eye peeping out of a mass of flesh that used to be a little face, a naked boy missing a penis, a girl whose vagina was removed by an orangutan's hand. The captions explained the scenes in detail. The children looked like war casualties. Mind you, some of the Rothschild art of black and white figures, of blacks attacking and slaughtering the whites, torturing them, fucking them. Chad couldn't believe it, but he heard Ackerman giggling. She was doing it quietly at first, then loudly, openly amused by the sight of all that suffering. That's what human children get, she said, for opposing injustice. Aren't you human, doll? He asked. She rolled her merry little eyes and made a merry little mouth, as if the photos were self-evidently pleasing to all who were in the know. He looked closely at this strange woman, a medical doctor. Her pasty face seemed patrician, but a trace of dark circles around her eyes and the same darkness, only hinted at, in all her visible skin, reminded him of Josh, who had the same characteristics, those of an albino Haji. That was the only way Chad could describe their vibe to himself. Josh, of course, had worked for her. That was the FBI guy who set him up, as you'll recall. She frowned, sensing disapproval. Do you think you're qualified to judge art? He shook his head. No, ma'am. So why are you showing me these things? His innocent face egged her on. It was part of her pleasure in this encounter that she could be herself, let it all hang out. I bet you think I'm an ape-loving communist. I wondered why you have that agitprop. Her laugh was a bark. I greatly admire the Soviet Union. It was the first government in modern times that punished anti-Semitism with death. Now we have the same law here. I'm a Jew. Okay. Do you know what that means? He shook his head. No. We're achievers. We appreciate art, whether it offends you or not. Our successes come from hard work and respect for education. Chapter of the title, right? Chad nodded. I bet you're an educated lot. And powerful. She looked at him silently with veiled eyes. You have power over people. I bet you're even hooked up with the government. Shut up. He went on in a hushed, admiring voice. You could even get people hurt or killed if they were bad. I mean, I want to know if you could have someone whacked. Soliciting murder is a serious offense. Are you asking me? That's what I mean, Chad said. You could have people put in prison. You just call the FBI. I could put you in prison. For her, the thrill, the temptation, was to reveal more, rub it in his face. I have had people put away. Terrorists? For one, the boy who blew up that corporate campus in Maine. Did you see that story? We got him. I admire anyone who works for the government. You have to be really educated to do that. I don't work for the government. Chad went for it. I thought you said that you worked for the FBI. You have to if you stopped Killamall and got that boy. I assist the FBI. Killamall was a trap. I don't do arrests. The FBI was acting on orders from my friends. Have you heard of Paul Black? Blach. Chad tried to show incomprehension in his face. He knew Paul Black's name. Everyone did. Black was a famous technology industry billionaire. No, ma'am, I'm ignorant. That goes without saying. Killamall was his idea. And the boy... She stopped suddenly, frowning. Chad wondered if she had caught on that he was pumping her for information. But she led him to one of her photos. She pointed out a boy in it. He had a somber face, a naked body, and blood all over his lower half. That's the boy. So that's where he came from. Paul's idea, but you assisted, Chad repeated. She took his good hand and shoved it down her pants. You're going to assist me now. Whatever you say, doll. She led him to the bedroom, a nondescript hole of a space. It occurred to him that it would be a good idea to play up kinks. I'm impotent. The war. I just watch. She raised her eyebrows in surprise. Then she resumed undressing. He paid no attention to her nasty body. She came to him and said, her face full of the same smile that an owner would have when looking at a beloved but disobedient pooch. So I'll peg you already. I just like to watch. Take your clothes off. Do you need assistance? He shook his head no and got undressed as if for a shower in the army, coldly, without even looking. She made him lie on the bed and straddled him. She rubbed her pale, flabby breast sacks on his chest. She tried to get herself off. Chad wasn't lying about impotence, not exactly. He had no problem getting it up normally, but now it was dead as a doornail. She made sure to show him things to watch, since you like to watch, she breathed. She was trying too hard, putting her fingers in her mouth, moving down to the third knuckle. She put her tits and crotch in his face, rode his beard. As her breathing became increasingly irregular, she grunted with her eyes shut and her teeth bared in a sideways smirk. You're the common denominator. You people are a dime a dozen. You're common as beach sand. From catching a whiff of her breath, he realized she had been drunk the whole evening. Paul Blach, he thought. Paul Blach. He didn't notice whether she came or not. She passed out and lay on her side with her mouth open, looking like a dead opossum. He got into his clothes. He turned and looked at her again. He could do it. He could choke her out. She wouldn't even wake up. But he decided not to kill her. He understood that he had a larger mission to protect, and cameras likely filled the whole apartment. The thought that he was filmed in here cramped his stomach for a moment. At least he wouldn't be filmed trying to disable a camera. As he made his way to the elevator, he knew that his win was Paul Blach, the name that he was taking away. End chapter 15. Chapter 16, Love Wins. Love Wins. Chapter 16. The desk clerk had informed the media of Greta's presence. He told his friends and relatives, too. A crowd of fans gathered at the hotel. The fans waited to get in the hotel or to see Greta come out and wave at them. It was hard to know what they really wanted. Their faces showed every emotion. On returning from Chicago, Chad had found Jake and Greta hiding in his room. No curtain was open, no light was on, and the two were sneaking around in socks to avoid revealing their whereabouts to the ever-growing mob outside and even inside. He had assisted Jake with rolling her up in a comforter and wheeling her out in a luggage cart. The two men bundled her in the trunk unseen and drove off. They were parked on the Bismarck exit when she was let out of the trunk. She emerged shivering and smirking. She didn't even glance at the road to Bismarck. She only remarked, "That's show business," and got in the front seat, still swathed in the comforter. They drove to California, headed for the home of Paul Blach. Blach had many homes, but spent most of his time at his San Jose place. That's just south of San Francisco. He had places or palaces in various locales. Former Paris, the island of Majorca, the city of London, Nevada, where his parents owned thousands of acres, Berlin, Kiev. He attained his fame and current fortune by being credited with inventing the world's best social justice app called Report a Terrorist, RAT for short. His app empowered moral people to report humanist attitudes on the part of employees, business partners, bank customers, school children, or ex-spouses by pressing only one button instead of four. He sold it for $1.6 trillion. Now, this I like. I think this is the best thing in the book so far, the RAT. You could see something like that. Now, that's the most effective, cleverest bit of extension satire, let's call it. Projecting trends into the future that I've seen in the book so far. Report a Terrorist. He sold it for $1.6 trillion. Every news and gossip site featured his bald head as an icon of free enterprise, even though governments funded RAT, like Google, right? Begun with government grants, and had done the lion's share of the R&D, meaning all of it. And that is the actual technical definition of lion's share, all of it. People don't know that. They think it means most, but it means all. But commoners need role models, and no name stood for gumption more than Paul Blach. Again, B-L-A-C-H. I'm choosing to pronounce it Black. It could be Bloch, but normally with Jews, that'd be B-L-O, like Robert Bloch, the writer, B-L-O-C-H. But this is B-L-A-C-H. Paul Blach. Blach. Try to add a little throat action in there to Judaize it even more. As Jake, Chad, and Greta passed a San Jose city limits sign, they kept in mind their mission objective. Find out what Blach knows and stop these people. They were near the place when they pulled over and Chad got out to get some food. Jake objected since the only innocent face among them was his own. Both Chad and Greta were known to authorities. But Chad insisted on giving his prosthetic leg a shake and left Jake and Greta in the car. Greta asked Jake after a minute, "Will we die?" "We're already dead. Rebirth is the hope." "That's hilarious. Why did you ask?" She was examining her thumb. "Oh, you know, did I say any other crazy things?" "What do you mean?" "Do you remember any?" "You talked about your mother. You saw her in a clock, I think." "She didn't say anything for a minute. I know that one. I guess it means time's limited. She always asked me when I would get married. I never worried about it." "It will happen." "Always trying to make me feel better, aren't you?" "Ow, look at my thumb." He leaned forward. "I don't see any injury." She kissed his cheek. He immediately felt the inner warmth he used to feel with Janet. Why did the marriage have to end? He wondered. Why does love fail? It should continue. It's the most natural thing in the world. Mating and family, will they ever return? Could they be possible again? I think I'm in love with Chad, Greta said. Just then Chad got in the car, carrying a bag of vended food. About time, Greta said, without looking at him. Jake leaned back and said nothing. No one saw his grave smile. They knew that Block lived in this neighborhood, but they didn't know the address. They stopped at three houses before they learned it. Greta got it for him by asking whoever answered the door if Black lived there. I'm supposed to meet him, but my agent screwed up the address, she pouted. She explained that the meeting would involve Greta Ondrakova's America, that the Zed Channel would air her show, and that Black agreed to an interview. All that seemed implausible, but her star power disarmed people like fire melted butter. One of his neighbors gave Black away. It helped that Chad and Jake parked out of sight. The three had to move fast. They knew that cops would stop any unfamiliar vehicle here. This private neighborhood, where houses stood as fortresses of iron bars, remained open to traffic, but had security patrols equal to those of the globe's top gangsters, some of whom did have houses here. The three gained admittance to Black's and proceeded straight to the swimming pool and back, where the servant who opened the door directed them. Greta's million-dollar smile acted like a passkey. It turned off as soon as it wasn't needed, though. Night was falling, but the pool area was illuminated, and lights in the pool made its sparkling water glow like radioactive material. Short, squat, bald, shirtless, and hairy, Black sat poolside with only long black jeans on. He was alone. Paul, Greta enthused, I'm so glad to see you again. Black looked up from his phone. What do you want? Who are you? He interrupted himself and adjusted his heavy, black-rimmed glasses. Greta Ondrakova? Remember the drunk whore who wrecked all those cars? She asked. Black's naturally fluttering right eye stopped fluttering and his face changed from paranoia to somberness. He knew. He didn't make a move when Jake and Chad surrounded him, except to press a button on his phone, which they didn't see. Jake held Chad's .44 Magnum in Black's face while Chad snatched the tech innovator's phone and tied his hands with a rope. He threw the phone to Greta, who, watching avidly, caught it. They led Black out to the car. He had nothing to say except a pro forma, where are we going? He got no reply. They put him in the car and drove off. My people will miss me, he said, meaning his servants. No, they won't, Greta snorted. Jake and Chad said nothing. They parked at Lake Cunningham 20 minutes later. Somewhat to Jake's surprise, Chad untied Black's hand and pulled him behind Black's back and lashed them together again, then tied Black's feet together, hogtied him, and dragged him down an embankment. Black didn't say anything, didn't whine, didn't make an offer of money, didn't bargain as Chad shoved the back of his head into the water. He didn't even deign to look at his captors. Here's what we want, Jake said calmly. The sound of his voice, Black's eyes snapped into focus. He looked at Jake, and it was plain that the main reason for his silence was that he was full of fear. Who backed GAI? Jake asked. Black seemed to recover some composure. The backers of GAI? That's what you want? After getting no answer, he said, I know nothing about it. Liar, Greta shouted. But you know, Chad told Block, about Kill 'Em All. The Ackerman woman gave you away. Reva wouldn't know about GAI, Black chuckled. His silvery skin glistened with cold sweat, but his right eye resumed fluttering as normal. We only wanted to see what you would say, Chad said, and pushed Black's head underwater. He held it down for what seemed like too long a time. Jake almost got worried, seeing Black weaken after struggling and thrashing. Chad had waterboarded people before, though, and this wasn't very different. Laugh when I pull him out, Chad instructed Jake and Greta, and be loud. They did. Black was gasping. He looked at the three now, Chad's expressionless hatchet face, Jake's frighteningly direct eyes, Greta's blonde-haired, blue-eyed beauty bent to an anger almost mad in intensity, and he plotzed. It wasn't an explosion. He didn't scream. He only snarled quietly, you can't stop us. We're bigger than you. The operation will go on. Where are the rest of you? Jake asked. Tel Aviv, Brooklyn, Buenos Aires, everywhere we always were. What operation? What's he talking about? Greta asked. We're going to do it, Black went on. You can't stop us. The nations will die. Chad jumped on top of Jake and pushed Greta's head down. He heard the gunfire before they did. Follow me and take cover, he was saying, already running, but they didn't need prompting. They were on his heels. They left Black by the water, immobile like a beached but self-possessed fish. The gunfire was rifle fire, but men with sidearms appeared from the trees, surrounded Black, and then spread out. Apparently Black security people, they were looking for Jake, Chad, and Greta. The three's hiding place was a cluster of pines. In the last approach from the extinguished sky, they watched these people approach. Chad drew his .44 Magnum. A shot poked the air. It was from far away. Though the light had gone completely now, Chad could tell that another force had arrived and was shooting at Black security people. Who is that? Jake whispered. The police? Chad shook his head slowly, looking but mostly listening. Gunfire broke out from more than one direction. All he could do now was make sure that Greta and the TL, the team leader, stayed flat and didn't raise their heads. After a minute, a soft, oh, came from Greta. Chad knew immediately that she was shot. Before he could do anything, a searing light fell upon them. Standing behind it, two soldiers jerked Chad and Jake up, shoved them forward in a stumbling march, and loaded them in the bed of a pickup truck. They took Chad's gun. They were shouting at each other. Chad and Jake saw only the outlines of a Glock 22s. The light was intense because it came from military-grade flashlights. Where's Greta? Chad said angrily. Where is she? He struggled to get up, but got knocked unconscious by a baton of some force, of some kind. When he came to, he and Jake were on the tile floor of a room lit by a shaft of morning sun. The one window looked high up from their vantage. They weren't bound, but Jake was too sore to get up, and Chad didn't want to. He thought that Greta was dead. He knew she was shot last night. She wasn't here. A thought came to him, a memory. In the memory, she was saying what she had said about molestation. He tried not to wonder if she and Black were ever a couple, something he had worried about at the lake, seeing how mad she was. What he was remembering her saying was this: "You feel that you participated, like it's your desire. You could hate yourself." He concentrated on that. It helped him with a lingering disgust from the Ackerman encounter. Jake was thinking slowly, "Greta is dead." He recalled her saying something at Groat's farm. Without a sense of humor, what's the use of living? "We failed the objective." Chad said it. Jake looked at him. "It's over," Chad added in a flat voice. Jake knew that he meant more than their mission of stopping the criminal conspiracy to destroy the world. "What's over, Mr. Bingham?" he asked. "Everything." "You plan on checking out?" "Don't try to stop me, TL." Chad removed one of his socks, walked to the door, and tried to turn the knob. The door was locked. He tied the sock to the knob. Jake stood up. "What are you doing?" He took Chad's arm. Chad pushed him back. Jake tried to tackle him. That was harder than he thought it would be, despite Chad's almost losing his balance on his prosthetic leg. Chad pushed him back again. "You once told me TL means team leader," Jake said breathlessly, "so follow me. If you trust me, if you trust one person, life will be worth it." After a moment, Chad shrugged and untied the sock. "He was going to hang. You can hang yourself from a door handle. You can do that. People have done that in prison. After a moment, Chad struggled and untied the sock. Jake checked on the window and found it sealed shut. Chad put his sock on. Jake checked the door himself. Chad said, "I wonder where the hell we are, sir." "In jail, Mr. Bingham." "Are jails like this?" The room, though bare, was wallpaper. Suddenly, the door opened. 135, and that's the end of chapter 16 and part 2. So we're 2/3 of the way through, and after their operation, they wind up shot and jailed. So we'll see where it heads next. I've been Alex Linder, reading to you out of Mike Smith's 2024 novel, The Eradicator. This was chapter 15 and 16. Thanks for being with me today. And as always, everything is permanently archived and stored at vnnforum.com. I'll be back with you again for more from The Eradicator real soon.